That's the story of, that's the glory of love.
The mere fact that a remake has been made and released is testimony to the classic nature of this original. Made in 1967 amidst the tumultuous times in America, this film made people take note. It made them stare face to face with the issues they'd been dancing around for years. This film is also at the cusp between the Hollywood factory of old and the new film industry born in the 60s. It tells a tale of cinema history as well. Billed as a comic drama on race relations in the 60s, this film becomes the epitaph for one of the greatest collaborations in cinema history, that of Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. No wonder it proudly takes its place in the AFI's top 100 greatest movies ever made list. Hi, welcome to Screen Gems. I'm Rennie Mann, and this is Stanley Kramer's Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
That's the story of, that's the glory of.
Even Variety's original review from 1967 was effusive, and I quote, "Problem. How to tell an interracial love story in a literate, non-sensational and balanced way. Solution. Make it a drama with comedy. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is an outstanding Stanley Kramer production, superior in almost every imaginable way, which examines its subject matter with perception, depth, insight, humor, and feeling." Ooh, not bad. But 2005 is a different ballgame. We're going through a period where remakes and sequels are par for the course. All the suits feel they need to play safe with their blockbuster budgets. And obviously, the selling of a remake of a successful classic is much easier than trying to sell something new. I know we should never say never, but one could not believe that anyone would dare remake Citizen Kane, or Casablanca for that matter. Even though, as per the latter, filmmakers have tried to tell the same story again and again, in a different period and a different context, with a different ensemble, but usually to disastrous results. Cabo Blanco and Sidney Pollack's Havana spring to mind. As with Shakespearean stories, much of the essence the drama is made of, some stories should be told again and again, but not remade. There could never be another Rick. It has to be Sam playing it again, playing it one more time. The Wild Bunch was a wonderful retelling of the Seven Samurai. And in fact, Battle Beyond the Stars, a further retelling of the story in sci-fi, was one of Roger Corman's best films. But Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is not a film or story that should be told again. Sure, tell another story about forbidden love, but not this same story. The original Stanley Kramer production of 1967 is a classic of space and time. It's a very simple story, set in complicated and tumultuous times, with those in front of the camera and those behind being major links in the chain of cinema history. Of the history of our times, in fact. When those bars of Frank Duvall's Glory of Love open over the whoosh and thump of that 707 landing at San Francisco International, we know we're in for a treat. We obviously all know the basic story. The initial trailer put it so succinctly.
Three Academy Award winners and a bright young newcomer combine their talents in a love story of today.
This is the story of a new kind of love. But it's really the age-old story of forbidden love. Just that in this instance, the reason that the love is forbidden is the clash of race. He's black and she's white. The line of drama of the story is whether both sets of disparate parents, the old generations, accept the union of their kids, the new generations, or even allow the union to take place. A dramatic device is introduced to squeeze the most drama from the situation. That is, the parents have to decide by the end of dinner. This movie is described as a drama with a touch of comedy, not in the he-horse sense, but the comedy that comes from the warmth of human nature. Some would describe that as schmaltz, and schmaltzy it certainly is, but that doesn't stop you from feeling warm and fuzzy inside. Now the story must be placed in the context of the times, even though it does stand on its own 2 feet any time, especially judging by Hollywood's acceptance of the remake today. In general, the latter 60s America was in tremendous tumult and upheaval. The Vietnam War was in full swing. The civil rights movement attracted the attention of all those pleading for a fairer and more equitable world. There was so much going on, perceptual change, legislative change, political change, some violent, some peaceful. In terms of the relationship between the races when the film was written and produced, there's one telling line where black father tells black son,
"Why, in 16 or 17 states, you'd be breaking the law. You'd be criminals."
By the time the film was released in 1967, it just wasn't true anymore, as the US Supreme Court declared that the laws in those states against marriage and cohabitation between the races was unconstitutional. In another instance of the tumultuous times,
"I brought you the latest bulletin. Guess who's coming to dinner now?"
"The Reverend Martin Luther King."
"Oh, dearie, you're so close. It's Monsignor Ryan. So bake a second pie, will you?"
Martin Luther King was tragically assassinated while the film was still in release, and the studio asked all the theater owners still screening the film to cut the line. Yes, the times were changing, but the story stayed the same. The film was written by William Rose, a grand American screenwriter, best known for his wonderful British comedies in the 50s, including the original Lady Killers. He won an Oscar for his screenplay and was nominated for 3 others. But the guiding force behind this project was producer-director Stanley Kramer, a legend in Hollywood who had worked with Rose previously on Kramer's only pure comedy, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which actually I'd like to talk about at another time. Although primarily responsible for some of the most interesting Hollywood movies of the 50s and 60s, Kramer never won an Oscar himself for any of the films he'd made. But the Academy did award him the Irving Thalberg Memorial Award in 1962 for his contribution to cinema. The word most used to describe the films he was most interested in is brave. All his films dealt with the issues that perplexed the times. Although many critics considered many of his films simplistic, he probably wore that description as a badge of pride. On the issue of why he's chosen the works he has, he's reported to have said, according to the BBC's obituary in 2001, quote, "If two people come out of a theatre in Kansas City and one said, 'You know, I never thought of it that way before,' that would satisfy me," unquote. The films that he's been associated with as producer include the original Home of the Brave, a study of racism in the army, one of the definitive adaptations of Arthur Miller's classic tale of the American Dream, Death of a Salesman, Fred Zinnemann's Western classic High Noon, which in reality was a thinly disguised attack on McCarthyism, Brando's The Wild One, and Bogart's classic, The Caine Mutiny, amongst many others. Films he both produced and directed include The Defiant Ones, On the Beach, Inherit the Wind, Judgment at Nuremberg, Ship of Fools, and with subjects including racism, nuclear madness, evolution and creationism, and Nazi war criminals. Yes, many of the most important subjects of our times. It should also be said that there is some controversy surrounding Kramer. Issues relating to his levels of professional collaboration or where he stood exactly during the blacklist period. But it should be clearly understood that nothing definitive has ever been aired and proven, and therefore it just has to be his overall body of work that finally represents the man. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner represents that aforementioned simplistic moniker perfectly. Here the white family is considered middle class, even though the reality of being a newspaper publisher in San Francisco, no less, and his wife running an art gallery that appears to have a hefty cash flow, and a house in the hills overlooking the most magnificent views of the bay, are all surely non-middle class in the extreme. And as for the black man, the intended for their daughter, he's an Ivy League-trained medical practitioner who's world-renowned because he has devoted most of his professional life to advancing medicine in the Third World through the World Health Organization and the UN. Yes, he's been married before, with family, but he's now widowed and alone after a horrific accident some years before. Yes, a loving family man, spectacularly successful. I mean, no matter what colour he is, who wouldn't want him marrying their daughter? This was the major criticism of the film at the time and still to this day. All the characters are imbued with a Hollywood gloss that doesn't exist in reality. But most spectacularly, the black male suitor is perfect. So, in reality, Kramer took those elements as a device to make the essential drama much more real. He maintains that, especially in the case of the black doctor, if the character had other flaws, whether they be professional or personal, the parents could have many other reasons to forbid the marriage. By making the character perfect, then the parents can have no other reason to withhold their support other than race. There is something to be said about this level of simplicity. Now, although I've waxed on lyrical about the film, what's been said up to now surely does not a classic make. The other element that completely elevates this film beyond so many others is the performances by all the lead actors, but especially by Tracy Hepburn and Sidney Poitier. One of the things about this film is that it's a bridge to another time and place of cinema history. Let's start with Tracy and Hepburn. Their personal and professional relationship is the stuff from where legends are born. Both individually and together, they were two of the most important actors to grace the silver screen. They both worked under contract to various studios at various times, and although part of the Hollywood factory, both appeared in some of the most memorable films of all time, making characters come alive, owning them. Being brought to Hollywood by John Ford in 1930, in 1 3-year period between 31 and 34, Spencer Tracy made 16 films. He's the first and only actor to win back-to-back Best Actor Academy Awards for Captain's Courageous in 1937 and Boys Town in 1938. Cinema history is filled with Tracy titles. Fury, San Francisco, Northwest Passage, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Old Man and the Sea, and Inherit the Wind and Judgment at Nuremberg for Stanley Kramer, as well as the aforementioned It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Hepburn was no slouch either. She came to Hollywood in the early 30s from Broadway, won an Oscar in 1933 for Morning Glory, her second year there, and lit up the screen. But her spiky personality and socialite airs cost her with the public and the business alike. After being branded as box office poison, she returned to Broadway in 1940 and tore up the lamplights in The Philadelphia Story, reportedly written for her. She purchased the screen rights to the film, had it produced with Cary Grant and James Stewart, and got nominated for Best Actress again. She was back. Then followed roles such as Women of the Year, State of the Union, The African Queen, Rainmaker, Suddenly Last Summer, Long Day's Journey into Night, The Lion in Winter, and On Golden Pond, for which she both won Oscars. And that's a total of 4, including the Oscar for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Which brings us to all the work and play they performed together. Hepburn and Tracy first worked together in 1942 in Woman of the Year, and behind the scenes immediately fell in love, starting what was probably one of the most intense and strange romances in Hollywood. And for Hollywood, that's saying a lot. Because Tracy was a devout Catholic, he could never divorce the woman he married in 1928, not till the day he died. Hepburn and Tracy were openly in love, even lived together, but could never get married. They made 8 other films together, including State of the Union, Adam's Rib, and Pat and Mike. Between her sharp wit and classy airs and his easy working-class personality, they were a match made in heaven. As reported in Wikipedia, when Joseph Mankiewicz first introduced them, Hepburn said, "Oh, I'm afraid I'm too tall for you, Mr. Tracy." And Mankiewicz replied, "Don't worry, he'll soon cut you down to size." And on screen they sizzled. As the London Telegraph observed in Hepburn's obituary, quote, "They were at their most seductive when their verbal fencing was sharpest. It was hard to say whether they delighted more in the battle or in each other, unquote.
I'll tell you something else. I couldn't do what you're about to do, so I don't begin to understand how you propose to go about it. But you can't break their hearts over a drink and then expect them to sit down to dinner.
I know that. Don't you think I know that? I have to talk to the doctor after. I'll talk to him after dinner. Tell him exactly how I feel.
Matt, I'm not trying to give you an argument. There's nothing I can say that you don't know anyway, but it's important that you understand just how wrong I think you... I believe you're making the worst mistake you've ever made in your... I think you're going to regret it with more bitterness than you've ever known and for as long as you live.
You're wrong. You're as wrong as you can be. Because I'm thinking of her, and even the doctor is going to know I'm thinking of her.
As the ingenue's parents, they bring a grace and humility to the roles. He, a Roosevelt liberal newspaper publisher, and she, well, pretty much the same. When first faced with the dilemma of acceptance of the union, Hepburn's mother is accepting virtually immediately.
Mom, this is John.
Dr. Prentice. I'm so pleased to meet you.
I'm pleased to meet you, Mrs. Drayton. I take it Joanna's already busted out with the big news.
Well, she has, told me a good deal, and all very quickly, too.
Oh, she's only known me for 10 days, so she can't tell you when I'm blushing. Mrs. Drayton, I'm medically qualified, so I hope you wouldn't think it presumptuous if I say you ought to sit down before you fall down, I mean.
He thinks you're gonna faint because he's a Negro.
Well, I don't think I'm going to faint. But I'll sit down anyway. Well, I suppose it would be all right if I said, my goodness, wouldn't it? Well, my goodness.
Tracy, on the other hand, is the key to the essence of the drama. His acceptance is not so clear-cut or immediate.
Matt, it's 6 o'clock. In an hour, they'll all be here for dinner, and the doctor's plane leaves at 10:45. No matter what it is, or when you say it, you're going to have to tell them how you feel.
I need more than one day to make a decision like that. It's the silliest thing I ever heard of. But I'll tell you this. I am not going to try to pretend that I'm happy about the whole thing, because I'm not. And if the doctor's decision depends upon that, then it's just too bad. And I'm thinking only of Joey's welfare. I have nothing against him personally, but he's a grown man. And he behaved irresponsibly in the first place by letting this thing happen. Now he wants me to be happy about a situation when I happen to know that they'll both get their brains knocked out. I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel. And I know how you're reacting. You're so wrapped up in Joey's excitement over the whole thing that you are not behaving in her best interest.
And it's Tracy who must be brought around. They are very subtle performances by two old hands. I mean, who else but Tracy could give a simple sequence of buying an ice cream sundae so much panache?
Isn't that the place where we got the good ice cream? Let's get some ice cream.
Oh, Matt, it's after 5.
Oh, a little ice cream can't hurt.
Yes?
Oh, well, when I had ice cream before, I had a special kind of flavor that I liked very much. But I can't remember what it was.
I'll bring you the list, sir.
Oh, no, you must know what it is.
Daiquiri ice, honeycomb candy, cocoa, coconut, Jamocha almond fudge, Mocha Jamocha peanut butter and jelly, cinnamon, banana, mint.
Must have been some other place.
Fresh Oregon boysenberry sherbet.
That's it. I'm sure that's it. Fresh Oregon boysenberry. Bring me a big one, huh? Mm-hmm. Will you have some? It's delicious.
No. Black coffee.
Okay, one double fresh Oregon boysenberry sherbet and one black coffee. Thank you.
It's been said that the roles was specifically written for them. In fact, it was Tracy's swan song, the last movie he appeared in. Although he suffered from many ailments, it was a heart attack that killed him a couple of weeks after the movie opened. It is reported that Hepburn never watched the final film. She always claimed it was too hard. Then, of course, we have Sidney Poitier as the man. It says much about the times, but Poitier was the only black actor who could have pulled off the role. He was the first who'd won an Academy Award for Best Actor, and the only black actor who could be fully accepted by a white audience without having to become an Uncle Tom. Poitier was a shining example of an actor's role in the business and role model in life. There was no black cinema yet. Black actors had to play in the white cinema industry. All his roles were associated or charged with facing racism. In 1967 alone, Poitier not only starred in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, but he also brought to life Virgil Tibbs in the Heat of the Night and Sir in To Sir with Love. To some extent, it was even up to Poitier to be one of the pioneers to invent black cinema in the 70s. No wonder he also received an Irving Thalberg Award from the Academy for his services to cinema in 2002. It was in fact the same year both Denzel and Halle Berry won for Best Actors. In this role, his character has to face not just her white parents, but even his own parents. Just like the dynamic of Tracy and Hepburn, his parents are split down the middle, his mother very accepting, his father not. He has to deliver the penultimate speech to his father, to every black father of that generation.
You listen to me. You say you don't want to tell me how to live my life. Let me tell you something. I owe you nothing. If you carried that bag a million miles, you did what you were supposed to do. Because you brought me into this world. And from that day, you owed me everything you could ever do for me, like I will owe my son if I ever have another. You and your whole lousy generation believes the way it was for you is the way it's got to be. And not until your whole generation has lain down and died will the dead weight of you be off our backs. Dad. You're my father. I'm your son. I love you. I always have, and I always will. But you think of yourself as a colored man. I think of myself as a man.
Yes, a bit schmaltzy and a little structurally difficult within the story, but still words that needed to be said, words that needed to be heard by the black community and the white community alike, and still do. And although the great drama for Poitier's character is with his father, the wonderful scenes are those he shares with Tracy.
Doctor, we've talked about a good many things. But there's one thing we haven't talked about. Have you given any thought to the problems your children are going to have?
Yes. And they'll have some. And we'll have the children. Otherwise, I don't know what you'd call it, but you couldn't call it a marriage.
Is that the way Joey feels?
She feels that every single one of our children will be president of the United States, and they'll all have colorful administrations. Well, you made her, Mr. Drayton. I just met her in Hawaii.
But how do you feel about that problem?
Well, frankly, I think your daughter is a bit optimistic. I'd settle for Secretary of State.
The other performers and performances are also of the highest caliber. Catherine Horton, as Tracy and Hepburn's daughter, brings the character's seeming naivete front and center, while successfully showing her steely strength throughout. Horton pulls it off wonderfully, helped by the fact that she's Hepburn's real-life niece.
Well, I got a right to my own opinions, and you want my opinion. I don't care to see a member of my own race getting above himself.
Then I don't want your opinion, and if I ever do, I'll ask for... Oh, Tilly, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. But you can't mean what you're saying either, and you're so wrong. Look, you're the last person I'd have expected to take such a silly attitude. You know I've always loved you, and you're just as black as he is. How could it possibly be all right for me to love you and wrong for me to love him? Will you just stop and think about that?
Although this was Horton's first film, you'd never know it. She's moved on to theatre as actress and playwright since. Poitier's character's parents are played by Bea Richards and Roy Glenn. Richards has been a prolific actress, poet and playwright since leaving Mississippi in 1950 at age 30 for New York. Her character spins the plot of this movie somewhat. In her memorable speech to Tracy, she places his issues into a brand new context that brings him to face the real demons he's been carrying.
I believe those two young people need each other like they need the air to breathe in. Anybody can see that by just looking at them. But you and my husband are, you might as well be blind men. You can only see that they have a problem. But do you really know what's happened to them? How they feel about each other? I believe that men grow old. And when sexual things no longer matter to them, they forget it all. Forget what true passion is. If you ever felt what my son feels for your daughter, you've forgotten everything about it. My husband, too. You knew once, but that was a long time ago. Now the two of you don't know.
Glenn had been a solid working actor since the late 30s. He had already worked with Poitier twice before in two classic works, Daniel Petrie's A Raisin in the Sun in 1961 and Otto Preminger's adaptation of Porgy and Bess in 1959. Their rapport is instinctive.
Well, Dad, I wanted to stop on the way back, but time got so short and I got to get to work.
Yeah, but I still don't understand why you couldn't spend one day with us.
Well, fact is, Dad, I met this girl.
You what? You met a girl?
Yes.
Well, why didn't you say so? Mary, he says he met a girl. Why, that's good. That's good news. She live up there in San Francisco?
Yes, yeah, she lives up here. I'm at her house now.
He says he's at her house now, at the girl's house. Well, that's different, son. Where'd you meet her? In Hawaii?
Yes, in Hawaii. And I wanted to meet her folks, you see.
That sounds good, son. I mean, serious.
Yes, it's serious.
I have to also mention the wonderful bit part played by Cecil Kellaway. He was nominated for an Oscar for this role as family friend Monsignor Ryan. He probably plays Tracy, the actor's, conscience in this role as a Catholic priest, doing all he can to keep the peace.
Monsignor Ryan, how wonderful to see you.
Good afternoon.
But why are you here when you should be in Hawaii? And what is the problem that caused your father to chicken out on our game of golf? And who is this gentleman?
Monsignor Ryan, this is John Prentice, Dr. John Wade Prentice. We met in Hawaii 11 days ago, and the two of us are going to be married.
Ah, indeed. I take it to mean to each other. Dr. Prentice. Well, of course, you're the problem.
Yes, I'm afraid I am.
Kellaway is one of those wonderful actors that you immediately recognize after having appeared in over 100 films and 30 TV shows. And then there's Maud. All in the Family spin-off. Sorry, there's Isabel Sanford as the family maid. Although best known for her role as Louise Jefferson, originally in All in the Family and then in her own series, The Jeffersons, she was a solid and exceptional Broadway actress for 30 years before coming out to Hollywood. This was her first film role. Her character brings to the dynamic that disassociated, stereotypical black perspective of the times.
How do you do, Miss Binks?
I got something to say to you, boy. Just exactly what you're trying to pull here.
I'm not trying to pull anything. I was looking to find me a wife.
Ain't that just likely? You want to answer me something? What kind of doctor you supposed to be anyhow?
Would you believe horse?
Oh, you make with witticisms and all, huh? Well, let me tell you something. You may think you're fooling Miss Joey and her folks, but you ain't fooling me for a minute. You think I don't see what you are? You're one of those smooth-talking, smart-ass niggas just out for all you can get with your black power and all that other troublemaking nonsense. And you listen here. I brought up that child from a baby in her cradle, and ain't nobody gonna harm a nun while I'm here watching. And as long as you are anywhere around this house, I'm right here watching. You read me, boy? You bring any trouble in here, and you just like to find out what black power really means. And furthermore to that, you ain't even all that good-looking.
Sanford was a pioneer like Poitier, being the first African-American woman to win an Emmy Award for Best Actress in a Comedy Series in 1981. As a production, this film also sits on the cusp between old Hollywood and new Hollywood, and a small lesson in Hollywood filmmaking history. The setting for the film is basically the San Francisco Hills home of Tracy and Hepburn. It's set more like a play than a film, which intentionally gives the feel of an old-fashioned drawing room drama. The characters very, very rarely leave the five walls of the home. When they do occasionally venture out, they are in motor vehicles most of the time, and all of the interior car scenes are shot on a soundstage. There is no interior location shooting at all. Even at the house, the views of the harbor are fake. The artificial sunlight is just Hollywood magic. Yes, there are elements that date the drama. The concept of a woman's place by her husband's side, the music is so 60s brash, the terminology of Negroes and blacks. But the things that don't date are the ones that make this movie special. The magical performances by a larger-than-life cast, the warmth and humor that the characters feel for each other, the universal issues that it espouses, and of course, Tracy and Hepburn. They just don't make them like that anymore, and never will. Hi, this was Rennie Mann with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.